Last week we saw Jesus arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane. This week we're going to see then what happened. We'll see that he went on trial before the religious leaders. We'll see today that he actually went had two trials. A trial before two different religious leaders. And then we'll also see that he had two political trials, or two trials before the Romans, or even three if you want to kind of look at it that way. So we'll be talking about this trials. These trials all happened in the wee hours of Friday morning, and then on into the early morning soon after the sun came up. Last week, as we got ourselves into it, we kind of looked back at some of the verses in Matthew that gave us a little background of how it got to this point. And we'll do the same today, but today from John. So starting in John chapter 12, to remind ourselves how people in Jerusalem felt about this rabbi that came from Galilee and was coming to celebrate the Passover in Jerusalem this time. Okay, John 12, starting at verse 12. The next day, the great crowd that had come for the feast heard that Jesus was on his way to Jerusalem. They took palm branches and went out to meet him, shouting, "Hosanna! Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord! Blessed is the King of Israel!" So, we have the week beginning with the great fanfare that Jesus was given on his entry into Jerusalem. Okay, he was given a king's welcome, shouts of praise to God for God sending Jesus. Okay. Now, it said there that the great crowd that had come to the feast, where did they come from? They came from all over. Jews from all over had come to celebrate the Passover. And they came from all over. It wasn't just people from Jerusalem. They heard about Jesus coming to town. Well, how could so many know about that? How could word have spread about Jesus so that so many people would come out of Jerusalem to welcome him into Jerusalem? Verse 17. Now the crowd that was with him when he called Lazarus from the tomb and raised him from the dead continued to spread the word. Many people, because they had heard that he had given this miraculous sign, went out to meet him. So the miracle that Jesus had performed not long before this, of raising Lazarus from the dead, was something that really made the word spread of him. People had already heard about Jesus from his ministry, but now this raising someone from the dead, and this guy that everyone knew was dead is walking around and he's alive. He's living proof. And so people wanted to see Jesus. People had heard even more about Jesus. And so Jesus was very, very popular. He was popular throughout his ministry. We've seen that. We've seen everywhere he goes, he's got crowds flocking to him. But now that popularity is just grown and grown, and you see that on Palm Sunday. Well, he wasn't popular with everyone. The Jewish leaders didn't like him very much. You know, we've talked about that. How did the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem feel about Jesus' popularity? Next verse. So the Pharisees said to one another, "See, this is getting us nowhere. Look at how the whole world has gone out after him." They were upset. They were frustrated that their enemy was so popular. Why didn't they believe in Jesus? You know, even early on, we see Nicodemus going to Jesus, who was, he was a Pharisee. He was part of the Sanhedrin, and he said, "Hey, we know they know that you're from God, because no one could do the miraculous signs that you're doing if they weren't from God." Jesus performed lots of miraculous signs. The whole raising of Lazarus from the dead, wasn't that enough to convince these Jewish leaders that Jesus was the Christ, or that Jesus was a man of God? Verse 37. Even after Jesus had done all these miraculous signs in their presence, they still would not believe in him. This was to fulfill the word of Isaiah the prophet, "Lord, who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?" For this reason they could not believe, because, as Isaiah says elsewhere, "He has blinded their eyes and deadened their hearts, so that they can neither see with their eyes, nor understand with their hearts, nor turn, and then I would have healed them." So it was a fulfillment of prophecy, of messianic prophecy that Isaiah had, that people would be blinded. They would close off their hearts. They would have dead hearts and not recognize the obvious truths that God had come down, that God had sent Jesus, that Jesus was a man of God, that Jesus was God. Well, certainly a few believe, the leaders believed, right? We've seen Nicodemus. We've seen Joseph of Arimathea. Did any of them try to convince the others? Verse 42. Yet at the same time, many, even among the leaders, believed in him. But because of the Pharisees, they would not confess their faith for fear that they would be put out of the synagogue. For they loved praise from men more than praise from God. So no, they didn't try to convince one another, or the others. In fact, they didn't even let the others know that they believed in Jesus. They were quiet. Why? Because they loved praise from men more than praise from God. And they didn't want to risk that. They didn't want to chance that. It was too big of a sacrifice to sacrifice that praise from men to let other people know that they believed in Jesus. Okay? They did not acknowledge Jesus before others. Who are we talking about today? We're talking about Jewish leaders. The highest group of Jewish leaders was what was called the Sanhedrin. Okay? It was the highest leadership council of the Jews. It consisted of 70 select leaders, chief priests, scribes, elders, okay, that were hand selected. And then there was the 71st, and that was the high priest. The high priest was appointed for life, and the high priest ruled the Sanhedrin. It was patterned after what God did with Moses back in Numbers 11. Look at verse 16. The Lord said to Moses, "Bring me 70 of Israel's elders who are known to you as leaders and officials among the people. Have them come to the tent of meeting so that they may stand there with you. I'll come down and I'll speak with you there, and I will take the spirit that's on you and put the spirit on them. They will help you carry out the burden of the people so that you will not have to carry it alone." So that was instituted there back with Moses, and it continued on. And that's what the Sanhedrin was. It took its calling from what God did there for Moses. During the time of Jesus, the Romans gave the Sanhedrin some power. They had the ability to uphold Jewish laws. They had the ability to punish people for breaking Jewish laws. And until 30 AD, which is just right before our story, they had the ability to execute people. But in 30 AD, they lost that ability. So here, you know, we don't know what exact year this is with Jesus, but it was 33 AD or something like that. They no longer had the ability to execute people. The death sentence needed Roman approval. You see that in John 18, verse 31. It's amazing looking at the timing of things, how there's a unique period of time where all the messianic prophecies could have been fulfilled. If the Jewish leaders were able to execute Jesus, how would they have done it? They would have done it by stoning. That's the Jewish way to do it. But instead, he was crucified, just as was prophesied in the Old Testament. We'll see that when we talk about Jesus' crucifixion, how it was all prophesied. No other point in time is a very narrow point in time when crucifixion was even used. So it's amazing, God's timing here. Was there any meritable reason why the Jewish leaders wanted to shut up Jesus? Maybe they were trying to protect God. Maybe they were afraid that Jesus would upset God. If they let Jesus go on, that would upset God and he would bring his wrath to them. Okay? That's something that the Jews were very concerned about. They experienced God's wrath with the exile. They sure didn't want to experience it again. So was that maybe part of the reason? Verse 47 of John 11. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. "What are we accomplishing?" they asked. "Here's this man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take both our place and our nation." Were they afraid of God's wrath? No, they were afraid of the wrath of the Romans. They were afraid that the Romans would look upon what was going on in Israel and say, hey, they can't even control their own people, and take away some of their rights and privileges, their ability to control themselves, their ability to rule themselves to a degree, their ability to maintain Jewish law. So they were afraid that they would lose their place, their position. It wasn't being afraid of God's wrath, it was afraid of the Romans. The Sanhedrin was composed of mainly two groups, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The leader of the Sadducees then spoke up and showed a, he made a statement that he said in pure selfishness, but it really was a great prophecy of what Jesus' purpose was all about. Verse 49. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, so you see Caiaphas was a Sadducee, he spoke up, "You know nothing at all. You don't realize that it's better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish." He was talking about it's better that we get rid of this Jesus guy than for us to suffer the wrath of the Romans. But in saying that, he stated what Jesus' purpose was really all about. Better for you, better for me, better for all of us that one man, that Jesus Christ die for the people, for us, than that the whole nation perish, that all of us perish. What a great statement of what Jesus' purpose was. How could he have coincidentally said something so pointedly like that? Verse 51. He didn't say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. Okay? God was speaking through him. It sounded like a selfish kind of statement that he made there. It sounded like a statement that fit with what they were concerned about. But instead, God was using this person who was an enemy to Jesus to talk about what Jesus was really doing here. Now, when John recorded this, did he feel that there was anything else that he needed to add to Caiaphas' prophecy for the Jewish nation here? Verse 52. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and make them one. Here John is talking about that Jesus didn't come just to save the Jews, but he came to save all people and to bring all people together under him. Okay? We hear Paul saying that over and over again. Here we see John making sure that that point is made here. Did anything result from this meeting of the Sanhedrin? Next verse. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So they planned to get rid of him. They plotted to take his life. All right, and we talked about that last week. How were the Jewish leaders finally able to find Jesus without having a crowd around? Because they decided that it was too risky to try to arrest him with crowds around, because the crowd supported Jesus. The crowd could turn on them. There could be a riot. So they were at first going to wait until after the Passover, after the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which would be another week later. But then they didn't wait, because something happened. They were able to find Jesus without having a crowd around. Chapter 18. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. On the other side there was an olive grove, and he and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place, because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas came to the grove, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and Pharisees. They were carrying torches, lanterns, and weapons. So we see that they got some inside help. Judas, one of the 12, came to the Jewish leaders and offered to turn Jesus over. And so he took a contingent of temple soldiers to Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane. Okay, on Passover, well, the night of the Feast of the Passover. So this would be Thursday night, Friday morning, probably around midnight or so, is the guess. Was Jesus expecting him? Going on. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked him, "Who is it that you want?" "Jesus of Nazareth," they replied. "I'm he," Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with him. So yes, Jesus knew what they wanted. Jesus knew they were coming. He was expecting them. And when they came, he went out to them. He went out to greet them and introduce himself. "Hey guys, I'm Jesus, okay? I think you're looking for me." Jesus knew what was going to happen. He knew what was in store for him. He knew where this was leading, even more so than those that were there to arrest him knew. Jesus had just spent the night praying, had just spent an hour or two praying to the Father, asking if there were any other options. Let's take those other options. And we talked about that last week. Knowing what lay ahead for him, Jesus was grieved to the point of death. Okay, he was sorrowed to the point of death, he told his disciples. with all that on his mind, what really was the most important thing on his mind? What was he most concerned about? Verse 8. I told you that I am he, Jesus answered. If you're looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those that you gave me. His greatest concern was the well-being of his disciples. Even though they were going to fall away, even though they weren't as devoted to him, he was devoted to them. And we see that in Matthew 26:56. It says, all the disciples deserted him and fled. Well, Jesus being him going out to the crowd, you know, the crowd was ready to chase him down, track him down, do whatever, but he came out to them and gave himself to them. Since he was so cooperative, did they just ask him to come with them? Verse 12. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him. And no, they arrested him and bound him. Okay, tied him up. They took him somewhere. Where did they take him? Next verse. They brought him first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. So they took him to Annas. Why? It even says right here that Caiaphas was the high priest, and Annas was his father-in-law. Why would they take him to the father-in-law of the high priest rather than taking him to the high priest himself? Now, look at Luke 3, verse 2. This is when it's talking about when John the Baptist started his ministry. It says, during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to John, son of Zechariah, in the desert. Here it says that the high priest was Annas and Caiaphas, that two people were the high priest. But you know what? That's not the case. There was only to be one high priest, and there was only one high priest. But, so why does it say Annas and Caiaphas were both high priests? Why did they take him to Annas rather than taking him to Caiaphas, who was the high priest? All of this shows the power of Annas. We've talked a little bit about Annas before. Let's talk a little bit more and remind ourselves a little bit about Annas. Annas had been high priest from year 6 to year 15. Okay? We're in year 33 or thereabouts now, right? So it had been 15, 20 years since Annas had been high priest, quite some time ago. But the Jews considered the high priest to be high priest for life. You kind of see an example here of Acts 4, verse 6. Annas the high priest was there, and so were Caiaphas, John, Alexander, and the other men of the high priest family. This happens after Jesus ascends. This is in the book of Acts. This is when Peter and John are before the Sanhedrin. And here Luke, writing this, calls Annas the high priest. But we know Annas was not the high priest then because he was only high priest from year 6 to year 15. And instead, Caiaphas was high priest. But yet, Caiaphas isn't mentioned as high priest. Annas is. So the Jews recognized Annas as being the high priest because he was there for life. But the Romans, they saw this as a way to make some money. And so they auctioned off the high priesthood to the highest bidder. So they made a little bit of money at that. And for a while, Annas would be the high bidder and he would be the high priest. But eventually he found that, you know, it wasn't that important for him to officially be the high priest. He had the power and it was a lot more profitable. He could make a lot of money doing other things as long as he had the power. So what his concern was that he maintained power, but he didn't care about the title. So he still bid on the job, but had the Romans appoint members of his family. And he went through five of his sons. He went through his son-in-law and even a grandson as high priest. But yet he still maintained control. His son-in-law was Caiaphas, right? They all kind of lived together in this palace of the high priest. Okay, so even though Caiaphas was high priest and quote-unquote was officially the keeper of that palace, Caiaphas lived there and he really probably kind of ran that. It was a large building with a central courtyard and numerous rooms around that. So both Caiaphas and Annas would have lived there. Annas was very wealthy. And that was really what he was most concerned about, is he owned what was called the Bazaars of Annas. We've talked about that before. The Bazaars of Annas were set up in the temple. Okay, right there at the temple, inside the temple, in the court of the Gentiles. And he would sell temple-certified sacrificial animals to people who came to make sacrifices. He would also, he also was responsible for the money changers who would convert Roman money into temple money that could be then given as an offering, because Roman money was too dirty, too unclean to be given to God. At the beginning of Jesus' ministry, and again at the end of his ministry, on the Monday of his last week, what did Jesus do? In both times, he went and turned over the tables of the money changers and kicked the marketplace out of the temple and said, "How dare you turn the Lord's temple into a marketplace?" When he did that, who was he threatening there? Whose face was he getting into? Annas's. Okay? So Annas had a personal beef with Jesus here, because Jesus was condemning Annas's business, what Annas was all about. Okay? Annas had a lot of power, not only because his family members looked up to him and he maintained the high priesthood for his family members, but he also made sure that the Romans liked him. And he took care of that by bribing key Roman leaders. And that kept him in power and kept him in position. Annas' abuses were well known, so much so that even later Jewish historians referred to Annas as a prime example of a corrupt high priest. Okay? That's who Jesus was dealing with here. So they took Annas, they took Jesus to Annas. Now, Annas wanted to get rid of Jesus, right? Because Jesus was a threat to his business, if nothing else. That was Annas' probably biggest concern. Okay? Would Annas have any trouble getting his son-in-law to get rid of Jesus? John 18, verse 14. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it would be good if one man died for the people. Okay? Caiaphas has already given his position in this thing. Jesus needed to die. He was creating too much trouble for him. Okay? So Annas and Caiaphas were already on the same song sheet. I'm sure they had talked about it before. Alright, so they took Jesus to Annas. Now, what kind of information did Annas want from Jesus? Verse 19. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. Okay, the high priest. Yeah, that is Annas. Annas questioned Jesus about how many disciples do you have? How big of a following do you have? Okay, how large is this group that we have to be concerned with? Okay, if it's only 12, big deal, right? If it's hundreds, that's something to be concerned with, right? So the size of his following. And then he also wanted to hear what Jesus had to say about what he believed. Something, maybe he would say something blasphemous, something that's punishable, something that they could stick a charge on, right? Now what Annas was doing here was illegal according to Jewish law. Anytime a person was on trial, witnesses first had to establish guilt. Okay, you were not to start questioning the defendant, the accused. But here, that's what they start doing right away. So, Annas is wanting some secret ideas or secret beliefs from Jesus. What kind of secret ideas did Jesus reveal to Annas? Next verses. "I've spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. So why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said." Okay? There were no secret ideas. Jesus had been out in the open with everything. "I've always spoken openly." You ask anybody. Okay? If you want to hear what I believe, just ask anybody. Because many people have heard me. I've been open. There's nothing secret here. What was significant about his response? Go back to Isaiah chapter 45, verse 19. "I have not spoken in secret from somewhere in the land of darkness. I have not said to Jacob's descendants, 'Seek me in vain.' I, the Lord, speak the truth. I declare what's right." And then also 48 verse 16. "Come near to me and listen to this. From the first announcement, I have not spoken in secret. At the time it happens, I'm there. And now the Sovereign Lord has sent me with the Spirit. So in both cases, both prophecies there say that he would not speak in secret. And Jesus fulfilled those prophecies. Well, how did the Jewish leaders feel about Jesus standing up for his truth before Annas like this? Verse 22. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby struck him in the face. Is this the way you answer the high priest? He demanded. Okay. They were getting frustrated. They were already frustrated, even before things started here. And frustrated at losing this argument or having Jesus talk back like that, one of them just slapped Jesus in the face. How did Jesus use this violent action to further demonstrate his truth? Verse 23. If I said something wrong, Jesus replied, testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, then why did you strike me? Okay? So, what are you upset about? If I said something wrong, tell me. But if I didn't, why'd you hit me? Well, Annas could see where this is going to go and that Jesus isn't going to cooperate with telling him what he wants to hear. And Annas knows all the stories about how Jesus is so wise that he can turn anything around, and he's already turning something around here. So, Annas is not the one who needs to show that Jesus needs to be executed. That's Caiaphas' tough job, right? So what does Annas decide to do? Verse 24, then Annas sent him, still bound, to Caiaphas the high priest. Okay, so he sent him on to Caiaphas and the rest of the Sanhedrin. And this still was, this was early in the morning, probably around 1 o'clock in the morning, that that he sent him, still bound. Well, as we said, the Sanhedrin was a ruling body of the Jewish leaders, and surely they wanted to make sure that justice was done. Okay, they were the representatives of God's justice, right? So would Jesus find justice and protection of the innocent before the Sanhedrin? Matthew 26, verse 57. Those who had arrested Jesus then took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. Doesn't sound like a whole lot of protection there, does it? Doesn't sound like a whole lot of justice. Sounds like they have already decided the verdict, and they just needed a crime to lay the verdict on, right? They'd already decided his sentence. They just needed a reason. Well, but this is the Sanhedrin. This is the highest power of the Jews. Couldn't they do whatever they wanted? Couldn't they make any ruling? Why did they need any evidence? Well, they at least tried to make a little semblance of propriety, a little semblance of doing things rightly. We'll talk on page 4 about how this whole trial was completely illegal, but you know, let's take a look. Deuteronomy 17, verse 6. It says, on the testimony of two or three witnesses, a man shall be put to death, but no one shall be put to death on the testimony of only one witness. Well, that's pretty clear-cut. Okay, the Jewish leaders had their own rules for how to conduct court and stuff like that, but this one here is pretty black and white, what God laid out here. That no one could be executed, which is what they wanted for Jesus. No one could be executed unless there were at least two witnesses that had the same testimony. Okay? So, they start looking for some witnesses here. They needed some evidence here against Jesus. Now, as active as Jesus had been, because he's been out there for 3 years, people have seen him, people have heard him. How many sets of witness came forward with stories here? First part of verse 60. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. So lots of witnesses came forward saying different things, but they couldn't find two of them that would agree. Okay, they couldn't find two witnesses that had the same accusation. But they kept chugging. They kept pushing. They kept trying to find something that could, on which they could convict Jesus to where they could execute him. By pushing hard for anything that could convict Jesus, pushing for anybody, hey, make up something, let's find two people who say the same thing. What commandment did they break? Exodus 20, verse 16, you shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Okay? They were directly breaking. They were trying to keep this Deuteronomy command of God. but in the process directly breaking that thou shalt not bear false witness against your neighbor. That's exactly what they were doing. They were bringing false testimony against Jesus, or trying to. Well, was the Sanhedrin ever able to find two people who agreed on some incriminating evidence? Mark chapter 14, verse 56. Many testified falsely against them, but their statements did not agree. And then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. Hey, we heard him say, I will destroy this man-made temple, and in 3 days I'll build another, not made by man. But yet even their testimony did not agree. You got two guys who are kind of hanging their hat on Jesus threatening that he was going to tear down this man-made temple. But even their stories didn't match. But hey, it's getting close, right? Had Jesus ever made such a threat that he would tear down the temple? This temple had just finished being built. It took decades. This was the temple that Herod threw a lot of money in to build. It took decades to build, and it was had just finished. And here Jesus was threatening to tear it down. How could this rabbi from Galilee even do that? But hey, it's a threat, right? It's a threat against God's house. Had Jesus made such a threat? John 2, verse 18. Then the Jews demanded of him, what miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? Jesus answered them, destroy this temple and I'll raise it again in 3 days. The Jews replied, it's taken 46 years to build this temple and you're going to raise it in 3 days? Okay. So had Jesus said that he was going to tear down the temple? No, he said, you tear down the temple. I'm going to take the temple that you tear down and raise it up in 3 days. He was not threatening the temple. They were the threat to the temple. And besides, was it even this temple that he was talking about? Well, he was in the temple. Sounds like it, right? But going on, verse 21, but the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. And then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus had spoken. So no, he wasn't even talking about Herod's temple. He was talking about his body. He said, you're going to destroy this temple, my body. But on the third day, I'm going to raise it up again. Well, the disciples didn't quite get it there, but they understood later on after Jesus had fulfilled that, after the Holy Spirit came and explained things. So maybe that's the thing. Maybe they just misunderstood. Maybe the Jewish leaders just misunderstood what Jesus said. But look back towards the end of Matthew 27, starting at verse 62. This is after Jesus had died and was buried. The next day, the one after the preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. So what's the day after preparation day? Preparation day was the day before the Sabbath, where you prepared and you didn't do any work so that you wouldn't have to do any work on the Sabbath. Well, here it is on the Sabbath, and the chief priests and the Pharisees go to Pilate. They're working. They're doing things that they're not supposed to do on the Sabbath. Again, it was most important for them to take care of this Jesus problem, more important than keeping God's commands that they felt were so important too. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, the deceiver said that after 3 days I'll rise again. So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he had been raised from the dead. His last deception will be worse than the first. So they proved later, they understood what Jesus meant when he said that on the third day I'm going to raise this temple. They knew what he was saying. Okay? Because they proved it right here. Well, knowing that the leaders really understood what he had said and that he had not threatened to tear down the temple, how did Jesus respond? Verse 62 of Matthew 26. Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What's this testimony that these men are bringing against you? But Jesus remained silent. He didn't say anything. He remained silent. He didn't have to defend himself. Actually, defending himself was not part of the plan because he was to go through with the punishment. He was to go through with his crucifixion that was coming up. This fulfilled a prophecy. When Jesus gave no answer, it fulfilled Isaiah 53, verse 7. We looked at this last week. We'll look at it again. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shears is silent, so he did not open his mouth. So just like a lamb led to the slaughter, he did not open his mouth. He did not defend himself. Okay. Well, realizing that this twisted evidence really wasn't going to stand up, Caiaphas knew that. So he can't bank it on that. That does not give us enough. It really is not what he said. It doesn't give us enough for us to go and convict him to where we could execute him. So I still got to come up with something. So what did he try next? Rest of verse 63. Then the high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Okay? He stopped beating around the bush. He directly asked Jesus if he was the Messiah, the Son of God. Okay, tell us. We've heard you think this, you tell us. Are you the Christ? Are you the Messiah? Are you the Son of the living God? Now, when he asked that question, he didn't just ask the question because Jesus has already been silent. He said, I charge you under oath by the living God. So, why did he say that? What was the purpose of him saying that rather than just asking Jesus? Well, we've seen if you just ask Jesus, Jesus may not answer. But Leviticus 5 verse 1, if a person sins because he does not speak up when he hears a public charge to testify regarding something that he's seen or learned about, he will be held responsible. So by Caiaphas charging Jesus under oath by the living God to answer this question, it forced Jesus to say something. Okay? So what did Jesus say? How did Jesus point out that they already knew the answer to that and they had rejected his answer? Luke 22, verses 67 and 68. If you are the Christ, they said, tell us. Jesus answered, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you wouldn't answer. So he says, you guys already know. Okay, you know what my answer is. And if I tell you, not going to believe me, so why should I answer? And if I asked you what you thought, you're not going to answer me. Okay? But Jesus didn't stop there. He did answer the question. How did he answer the question even deeper than they expected? Verse 64 of Matthew 26. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied. But I say to all of you, in the future, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One, and coming on the clouds of heaven. Okay, he said, you said it. Okay, it is as you say. And you'll see proof of it. When the Son of Man comes on God's right hand on the clouds of heaven. When he said that, they knew, these learned Jewish leaders that knew the scriptures backwards and forwards would immediately think of Daniel 7. Daniel 7 verse 13. It's a prophecy that Daniel gave of the Messiah. He said, in my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man. Okay, the phrase that Jesus used. A son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. Just like Jesus said. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So Daniel had prophesied that the Son of Man, which was a reference to the Messiah, would come on clouds in heaven and be given all power, kingdom, dominion, authority. And that's what Jesus said. He said, yes, I am the Christ, the Son of God. I am the Son of Man, the Messiah. And you're going to see me coming on the clouds of heaven at the right hand of the Mighty One. Just as Daniel foretold. Just as was foretold in Psalm 110 verse 1 about sitting at God's right hand. When Jesus said that, that's what they would have heard. We see that by their reaction. How did they react to Jesus' reply? Going on. Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he's spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you've heard this blasphemy. What do you think? He's worthy of death, they answered. Okay. Here you see the reaction. Okay. We don't need any more witnesses. we've got 70 witnesses, or however many of the Sanhedrin were there. We've got plenty of witnesses. We've all heard his blasphemy. He has called himself the Son of God. He has called himself God. Okay? We've got plenty of witnesses there now. What was the penalty? What was the punishment for blasphemy by calling oneself God? Okay, or the Son of God like that. Leviticus chapter 24, verse 14. Starting at verse 13. Then the Lord said to Moses, take the blasphemer outside the camp. All those who heard him are to lay their hands on his head, and the entire assembly is to stone him. Say to the Israelites, if anyone curses his God, he will be held responsible. Anyone who blasphemes the name of the Lord must be put to death. The entire assembly must stone him. Whether an alien or native born, when he blasphemes the name, he must be put to death. Now, one of the things you can see here is that if the Sanhedrin, Caiaphas, all the chief priests and leaders, if they truly believed that Jesus was not the Messiah, that he was not the Son of God, and they apparently did, then that would be blasphemy, and what we just read in Leviticus is what was prescribed there. So what they went through with is what they thought that, and what they were told and what they understood that they needed to go through with. Their problem was their initial premise, that Jesus was not the Christ, that Jesus was not the Messiah, that Jesus was not the Son of God. And that's where they made their big mistake. That was their problem. Okay? But they were caught up in this, and they wanted more than anything to shut up this Jesus guy who is creating all this trouble for them. And it was more important to them to get him shut up than it was for them to find the real truth. Even the truth if Jesus was the Son of God. They weren't going to listen to that. We see that as an example in what we just read in Matthew 26:65-66. And catch it in Leviticus 21:10. Here's another rule. The high priest, the one among his brothers who has had the anointing oil poured on his head and who has been ordained to wear the priestly garments, must not let his hair become unkempt or tear his clothes. What did Caiaphas do? Verse 65, then the high priest tore his clothes and said he had spoken blasphemy. Someone tearing their clothes is when they're really upset, when something is beyond belief or beyond acceptance or whatever, or deep mourning, that kind of thing. Clothes were very expensive. People did not have many clothes. So when you tore your clothes, that was something that was way out of the ordinary. The high priest did it, even though it was commanded that the high priest not do that. But it was more important to Caiaphas that he make a point here rather than find the truth and do God's will in this situation. Okay, so he's guilty. He is worthy of death, they answered. Okay, they've got proof. They know for sure that they're going to do the right thing here by having him executed. But remember, the Sanhedrin no longer at this time had the right to execute. So if they wanted him executed, if they wanted him dead, then they had to get some help. Okay? What did they have to do? Matthew 27. Early in the morning, all the chief priests and the elders of the people came to the decision to put Jesus to death. Okay, that's what we just read. They bound him, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate, the governor. Okay, they had to go get the Romans to execute Jesus. They didn't have the right to do that. They had to go get the approval of the Roman governor who could execute someone. Well, we don't know the exact times. We don't know exactly when it was that they came to the decision that he's worthy of death, that they believe that they heard blasphemy coming from Jesus' lips, just like he said, if I tell you, you're not going to believe me. And they didn't. But there was a time, because it wasn't sunup yet. And so there was some time to wait until the Roman governor would be awake and be able to receive them. And they'd be able to get an audience with Pilate the governor. So what did they do to pass the time? Luke 22, verse 63, you can also see it in Matthew 26:67-68, and Mark has a version as well. But let's look at the Luke version, starting at verse 63. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him. They mocked him. They beat him. They insulted him. They'd hit him and say, "Hey, you think you're so smart? You think you're a man of God? Tell us who hit you. He's got a blindfold on." Okay. And what does Jesus do? He accepts it. He stands there quietly like a lamb before the slaughter. Okay. Isaiah 50 verse 6, we see it also fulfilled prophecies. "I offered my back to those who beat me, my cheeks to those who pulled out my beard. I did not hide my face from mocking and spitting." Okay. He offered himself to them to be beaten, mocked, and abused. So that's the trials before the religious leaders, Annas and Caiaphas, and the Sanhedrin. We'll study in a couple of weeks the trials before Pilate, and also we'll see Herod get in the picture there too. Next week we'll look at what some story that happened during these religious trials, and that's the story of Peter denying Jesus three times. Now, one other note here about these trials that we just studied is they were very illegal. They broke all sorts of laws that the Jews had set up for themselves when they held their religious trials. Okay, for example, a defendant, an accused person, was to be treated as if they were innocent until proven guilty, kind of like we have here in our country. Okay. Is that what they did then? Mark 14, verses 1 to 2. "Now the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread were only 2 days away, and the chief priests and the teachers were looking for some sly way to arrest Jesus and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or the people may riot." You see, even 2 days before the Passover, they had already decided the sentence. They had already decided that Jesus needed to be killed, that he needed to be executed. They were just looking for a reason. They were just looking. They had no charge for him. They just knew what they wanted to do to him. So he was guilty and not innocent. Then when they had witnesses, the religious leaders would carefully screen the witnesses to make sure the witnesses were trustworthy so that justice would prevail here. Is that what happened here? Verse 55 to 57 of Mark 14. "The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. And then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him." Okay? They did everything they could to try to find some kind of testimony that would stick against him. They didn't care who the witnesses were. They didn't care how true the accusations were. They needed to find two witnesses who would agree on something. Also, when they held capital cases for crimes, capital cases had to begin with reasons for acquittal, okay, of why this person should not be condemned. Is that what happened here? Luke 22, verse 66. "At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. 'If you're the Christ,' they said, 'tell us.' Jesus answered, 'If I tell you, you will not believe me.'" Immediately, the first words that we have from this trial, from the religious leaders, are asking him who he is, of going to him and trying to find ways to convict him, beginning to look to ways to convict Jesus. We have no one offering any reasons for acquittal here. Likewise, they had the rule that in a capital case that everybody could argue for acquittal, but not everyone could argue for conviction. You always had to have somebody who would argue the case of the defendant. Mark 14:55. "The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death, but they did not find any." We do not see anyone offering reasons for acquittal. We don't see anyone trying to defend Jesus. We don't see the Sanhedrin even trying to offer any defense or allowing any defense of Jesus. Okay? Another rule was that capital trials had to be held in the daytime, and verdicts had to be reached in the daytime, when people were awake and alert and able to think clearly and properly so that right decisions could be made. Well, what about this one? John 18, verse 28. Then the Jews led Jesus from Caiaphas to the palace of the Roman governor. By now, it was early morning. They went to see Pilate as early as they could, as early as they could see Pilate, when Pilate got up and was able to receive them. All of the trials that we see, all these accusations against Jesus, the religious trials, all happened in the dead of the morning, before the sun came up. Okay? So the trial was not held in the daytime, it was held at nighttime. The verdict was not given in the daytime, it was given in the nighttime. Okay? Why were they in such a hurry? Well, they wanted to get all this nailed down and in process before the crowds awoke and try to put a stop to it. If the crowds wake up and Jesus is already on the cross and already dying, there's nothing they can do about it, right? And it would be in the Romans' hands. They want to get it to the Romans' hands so that the Romans would deal with the crowds and not them. Another rule is that capital verdicts for acquittal could come the same day, but if they were going to be, a person was going to be convicted, it had to wait until the next day. That way it gave a night to sleep on it so that you made sure that you made the right decision before convicting someone incorrectly. What about this time? Mark 14, verse 64. You heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. And then the first part of verse 15, verse 1. Very early in the morning, the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law and the whole Sanhedrin reached a decision. They bound Jesus, led him away, and handed him over to Pilate. So we see he was brought in after midnight. Say 1 o'clock was when some of this trial was happening. And before sunrise, he was convicted and hauled off to the Romans. So he was convicted within the same half day. Not just the same day, but the same half day or even less. Same number, just a few hours. Another rule is that serious charges were to be tried only in the Sanhedrin's regular temple meeting place. Okay? Any kind of trial, any serious charge, something worthy of execution, that's a serious charge, right? That had to happen in the Sanhedrin's normal meeting place. Where was this? Where did this take place? Luke 22, verse 54. Then seizing him, they led him away and took him into the house of the high priest. In the house of the high priest. Both trials, both the one before Annas and the one before Caiaphas, took place in the high priest's palace. The Sanhedrin came to Caiaphas's house, or came to that palace, and that's where this trial took place. The last one I'll mention is similar to us, is they could take the fourth. The defendants were not required to incriminate themselves. Well, what about here? Matthew 26, verse 63. But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, I charge you under oath by the living God. Tell us if you are the Christ, the Son of God. Yes, it is as you say, Jesus replied, but I say to you, in the future you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. And then the high priest tore his clothes and said, he's spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you've heard the blasphemy. So Jesus was forced to incriminate himself under oath. Okay. Forced to give an answer. That incriminated himself and led to his conviction, led to his execution. So you see, this trial was not about a trial at all. This trial was just an act that was put on to give a semblance of look as if they were trying to do the right thing, but they weren't. What they were trying to do is to get rid of Jesus. And they were just going through the motions trying to do that. Let's pray. God, our Father, we thank you for the lesson that you've given us, for filling us in on the story of what happened and how Jesus was treated by the Jewish leaders. That he was wrongly convicted, that he was wrongly accused, that he was accused of being who he was, the Son of God. He was convicted. He was executed for claiming to be who he was. The Messiah. Your son. The one who came to save the world. The one who came to bring salvation to us. But the real reason he was executed was to bring us salvation. And we thank and praise you for that. We also thank and praise you for the forgiveness that you offer us. Forgiveness for times that we act like the Sanhedrin. That we don't rightfully tell the truth. That we don't rightfully speak up and confess our belief and our faith in Jesus Christ to those around us. Just like the members of the Sanhedrin who believed in him but kept silent. That we don't necessarily always look for the truth, but rather we look for what we want. Just like the Sanhedrin did there. And we can do so very wrongly, just like they did as well. We ask you to forgive us for that, and we thank and praise you that you do. Be with us as we continue to try to be your people. In Christ's name, amen.